Welcome to Gluck Radio. I am Dr. Errol Gluck, executive life coach and master problem solver. In recent months, I've had a growing number of young women coming into my office for treatment with eating disorders, namely ENDNOS, which stands for eating disorders not otherwise specified. It could be anorexia, it could be bulimia, it could be binging and purging. Before we start, I want to make it clear that ENDNOS, anorexia, bulimia, are hardly about food itself, and it is different for everyone. Food in the act of consuming it is just a byproduct. Rather, for some, it's about achieving perfection. While for others, it's about achieving the same kind of high that one gets for cocaine, drugs, and other substances. Many go for different types of therapy, hide this disorder, hold on to this disorder, and actually have this love-hate for the disorder. The act of purging, for those who don't know what purging is, it's the act of regurgitating whatever you take in so you just don't gain weight, gives individuals a sort of high or a sort of I am in control that keeps them continuing on in this process. This disorder absolutely dominates people's lives. It causes a tremendous amount of self-hate. To have the power to control one's weight seems to be a substitute for their lack of having control over past events of their life and their life now. It is an addiction. The tricky thing is that you can quit booze, you can quit drugs, you can not have sex, but you can't quit food. With us today, we have Elena Dunkel, an anorexic survivor and co-writer of Elena Vanishing, a memoir about her journey through recovery. Before I go further, I want to share a little excerpt from her book with our listeners, as it is so really truthfully and profoundly written with all her emotions. 17-year-old Elena has a voice in her head that tells her what she needs to do in order to be perfect. Put on her makeup, be charming and poised, make top grades, work out even 2 or 3 jobs, and never, never eat. You're an out-of-control bitch, eating whore. This is her inner voice. This is the voice she calls her conscience, and listening to it just might kill her. As Elena's body starts to break down and goes from one hospital to another, she comes to understand that her inner voice is her greatest demon. And in order to defeat it, she will have to face a secret she's hidden for years. This is a story of a girl whose armor against anxiety is artillery against herself. A girl battling on both sides of a lose-lose war. A girl struggling with anorexia. Thank you so much for coming on to the show. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Wonderful book. And to be honest, I'm doing this for 38 years. And this is one of the issues that comes over and over and over and up that I treat. And it is, you know, your book is just so relevant to speak to it. It actually means a whole lot to me.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you.
So why don't we kind of jump into the question is, tell me what made you write the book.
Okay, perfect. Well, I think there were a couple of reasons why my mother and I decided to start writing our stories. And I think the biggest one for me was how long the recovery process was taking and how frustrated I would become trying to find books that were relatable when so many of them that dealt with anorexia, they either kind of glossed over the actual recovery process or everything was very black and white. You had your disorder and then you didn't have your disorder, and that was very frustrating, and I really wanted to highlight to all those people out there that struggled long-term, just like I was struggling long-term, that there were people out there that did fall and have to get back up and repeat themselves over and over. So that was a big motivator. And also I think another big motivator was there really weren't that many memoirs out there that showed the dual perspective of fighting anorexia from both sides of the family circle from my perspective and my mother's perspective. And so when we sat down, one of the biggest things that we realized was that there were many things that affected her very negatively or positively, and they affected me in the opposite way, or they didn't affect me whatsoever. And so I think showing those people out there that when one person has a mental disorder, how much it really can affect that outer circle of family members, and then going into friends and going into acquaintances, and sort of showing the impact that it has on every single facet of life was a big motivator as well. So those are the two big reasons for me, and I think for my mother as well, to share our stories.
I mean, eating disorders are all encompassing. You know, every other disorder, of course, affects everyone's life, you know, to a certain extent. But for eating disorder, it's a 24/7. Let me start with tell our audience about your mother's eating disorder, and tell also about how it impacted you, and did it begin your eating disorder?
Well, my mother really didn't have an eating disorder per se. We did mention in the book that there was a genetic factor that people are now becoming more aware of, that there is sort of a nature and nurture aspect. But no, my mother's any issues that she had with food when she was younger, she was very wonderful as we were growing up, and I never saw any type of negative habits that she engaged in. And so mine was more impacted when I was 13. I was sexually assaulted by a male, and that really began, that trauma sort of triggered my obsession with food and being able to sort of reach a euphoric state where I would become so numbed out from restricting or from engaging in negative eating behaviors that I really didn't have to focus on something that was so devastating. I really didn't see it as devastating at the time, but I think it had more of an impact on me than I thought it did. And so really nothing related to my parents influenced my eating disorder. I think it was more for me, it was that trauma that I experienced at a very young age when you're just starting to learn about your sexual identity and all of those factors coming into play.
Okay, so your eating disorder, because that often is not the case in many cases. In many cases, there is a parent, parent's involvement of you look a little chubby, you could lose a little weight, and that does very much become a big part of the eating disorder. Also, fitting in and coming into one's own sexual identity, thinking that thin is better. Who the hell ever made that stuff up, that thin is better?
I think that is a very good point. There is quite an impact on younger children, and I would agree that there definitely is an impact on females to kind of fit a societal norm. But I really was raised, when I began my journey into my eating disorder, I was at an all-girls school, and there really wasn't a very intense factor on that. My parents raised me very well to, you know, there were no Barbies in the house. There was no television in the house. We were raised very, very kind of all-encompassing and never received any of that negative influence that many people do receive from their parents. And so I think that was one of the reasons too why we wrote our stories to, as my mother said in her book, she could never see something like that happening to her family. And I think it was because when she raised us, she did try and raise very strong-willed modern women, and ended up with someone who did have a disease that many people view is brought on by superficial ideas being influenced on them by society. And so that was very hard for her, but for me, I think it was less of a wanting to be attractive, and more that the only thing you can control in your life is what you put into your mouth type idea. And I do mention in my book, for me, it really did have nothing to do with feeling attractive. I mean, that's something that I also wanted to break that idea of is when you are in an eating disorder and you do have anorexia, it is very unattractive. Your skin breaks out, your teeth start crumbling, your skin turns yellow, you get little hairs all over your body. You don't look how many people think you would look if you did lose a lot of weight. I mean, I had people thinking that I had cocaine addictions when I was in college. People thought that I possibly had AIDS or cancer when they would meet me. You know, your hair falls out, and it is a very unattractive, very ugly disorder when you're really in the throes of it. And so that was something else that I wanted to highlight for all of those girls or boys out there who were kind of dabbling in dieting and wanting to be more attractive, that you hit a point where you're not at all anymore. And that was something very important to me to put out there.
And that very, very much appreciated. There is always a battle between the mammal brain, which is pretty irrational. It's very self-centered, and it kind of lives in a world of its own. And the frontal lobe, the rational brain that knows, you know, consequences and is fairly positive and solution oriented. When you did eat, tell me the thoughts and feelings that ran through your head. And I want to preface that at one point in the beginning, you wrote that inner voice said, "You're an out of control eating, binge eating whore." Now, that voice in your head, tell me about it.
I think the biggest thing that I've come to realize is that having such a low self-esteem, when my inner voice talks to me, just like everyone has an inner monologue going on, mine is always in third person, and it feels very much more judgmental. Like when I trip, instead of saying, "Oh, I tripped, whoops, that was silly," it's, "You tripped, you're so silly, you're so stupid." And so it definitely, having that inner critique that was almost felt like it was coming from a different place was very, very harmful to me and made me put a bigger magnifying glass on myself than I would think the average person would. And after being raped and going through that humiliation, that humiliating side of my inner monologue exploded at that point and just became very harsh. No matter what I would do, there was always something that I was doing wrong. And I had myself telling myself that I was doing something wrong, and it made it much worse. And it was very hard to cope with. And even now there's a lot of DBT therapy and journaling and working with therapists to really come to terms with that and be able to bring up that logical and rational side of my brain and say, "All right, this is why you're saying this. This is the feeling underneath it." And then try and work through that instead of, when I was younger, immediately accepting what that inner critic was saying and following its ideals, even though they were very, very bad for me back then.
Elena, that's why we use hypnosis, because it's so hard to overcome it rationally, because it really is that mammal brain tends to be a little OCD, and it goes over and over and over again. It doesn't let go very easy. So it's I just see the amount of work which you put in. By the way, the person who molested you, did you know them?
I knew the people who had brought me to that gathering, I guess you could say. It was myself and a friend. We were both very young, and we were involved somewhat. We felt romantically with two boys who were much older than us. They were in their 20s while we were still barely hitting puberty. And so they were the ones who brought us there. They were the ones who gave us the alcohol. But the man who actually did assault me, he was at the party, and no, I didn't know him. He was a stranger and, I guess, took advantage of a vulnerable situation that he saw he could take advantage of. And so that was very hard. I spread the anger that I felt to those other two people. I think feeling that they were partly responsible, I felt that I was responsible. I felt that everyone in the world was responsible, including myself. And it took quite a bit of time to overcome that and really focus the blame and the anger on that one person instead of kind of cascading it out to everyone that I could see had any influence on it whatsoever. So it was difficult, but I think I've reached a better place at this point.
Valerie was extremely important in your life, and her departure was extremely painful. Talk to me about what Valerie's part played in your life.
I think it was difficult, and I think one of the reasons why her departure had such an influence on me was because I did feel that our family is very talkative, and we have the dinners every night together when I was younger and the breakfast every morning, and we didn't have any type of outside entertainment really to distract us. My mother was a librarian, and so we were very much focused on our inner core. And so when I had reached a point of somewhat deciding within myself, partly out of shame and partly out of pride, to not tell anyone what had happened, I knew that if there was someone that I would tell, it would be her. And so I did isolate her, and she's very much a homebody, much more than me, and she's very dependent on family, much more than me. And so I know that the way that I had acted towards her, which she had absolutely no rationalization as to why, because she didn't know what had happened. I know that that impacted her and spiraled her into a depression and into a longing to find a family that she could belong to, and it was very confusing. And so when she did leave, I felt responsible, and I felt a somewhat unjust anger as to why people weren't trying to push harder for something I wasn't saying. How could no one see it? And so it definitely did. That was when I was in high school. I was already had issues, and then I was a very angsty, somewhat emo teenager. And so her leaving sort of, I guess, solidified in my mind what I had begun to tell myself, that this was just you. There is nobody else that can help you. And it definitely influenced me in a negative way, as I had influenced her in a negative way. And so that was a very difficult time.
Why did all the anger go a lot towards yourself, as opposed to saying, this person who violated me, he's a son of a bitch, he should drop dead and burn in hell? Why did you turn it against yourself?
I think part of it was, my parents raised me to be very much aware, and my mother was great in explaining. I definitely wasn't raised as one of those people who was 13 and had no idea what sex was or what a sexual life involved and how someone should prepare for it. And so I think that being raised with a lot of advantages of having a very academic family and being very educated in almost all aspects of life, I felt that I had been prepared for situations like that, and I had somewhat knowingly gone to a situation that was very sex oriented and alcohol oriented, and that was not how I was raised. And so instead of, I think, being so young, instead of seeing that this was someone with a more mature mind, they should have known what they were doing, I took it as, I am mature, I've been told I'm mature, and I still allowed myself to go there and put myself in that situation. And it is a very common thing, I think, for victims to blame themselves. There's, what if I hadn't got on the train? What if I hadn't worn that outfit? What if I hadn't gone upstairs by myself? Maybe I did flirt a little too much with people. And so there's just a constant inner critic cycle that starts, and it almost, it makes you, or at least for me, it made me feel better. It made me feel less out of control, thinking that it was I who was in control of the situation, that I had sort of created the situation to happen. And so in a way, it made me feel better. If that happened to me while I was doing that, I just will never do that again, was sort of my thoughts. And so I did take the blame fully on myself, and then that blame turned into fury towards any male figure in my life for a long time.
When you finally shared with your mother, what was her interpretation of the event?
Well, like my mother said in my book, she knew something had happened, from the way my personality changed to the way that I became very cynical and very angry and very dark. And so I think it was a relief for her to finally know. It was a relief for her to finally be validated, and that she did know her daughter, that I wasn't as much of a stranger as she thought I would, that there was a, I think it was very helpful to my family, and later on, I didn't realize it, but later on it was to myself, to know that there was a point to focus on and to work on that, and then be able to move on from there. But it was, of course, very painful. She, my mother and father, dedicated their lives to their children and to raising us, and to, you know, they are our protectors. And so I know it influenced her, sort of the grieving process that I went through when I was 13, then my mother went through all those years later. I know for months she didn't get out of bed. I know it was very hard on my father. And so I think it was very difficult, but I think it was also very good having that out in the open and knowing that the whole family was on the same page as where to proceed and how to work on my recovery and our family's recovery together.
Yeah, it did seem like what happened was not happening to you, but happening to your entire family. Now, the anger towards men that you felt, did that extend to your father or no?
I don't really think it extended towards him. I think I know my father would have probably completely over. I think one of the biggest things I was afraid of is we were in a foreign country and the man was a foreign man. He was a man from that country. And so I was very much afraid that if I were to say anything or if anything were to happen, if my father was to express his anger in a negative way towards that person, that we would be embroiled in something that involved two countries. And I had seen people in the military, if something happens that's negative, they can send your whole family home. Your parents will lose their jobs. And so I was very much afraid of having what happened to me ripple out and affect the way that our families' lives were all progressing. And so I was afraid of that, but I don't really think I turned that negative feeling towards him. I know that it was more towards people, men sexually, is how I focused that anger. I think it was more peers and people who weren't related to me is the ones that I felt would take advantage of me.
Now, normally in eating disorders, there's so many different types. They can involve restriction. They can involve simply not eating at all. It can involve bulimia. Tell me about not only the cycle of your eating disorder, but the feelings that you had as you were going through it. Because
I think
at one point you kind of present the disorder as your armor or protection, and there's some euphoria rather than disgust associated with it.
And there is, I kind of, whenever I'm talking to people about it, I call it the honeymoon phase of the disorder. And there is a, I guess you could almost say a good phase of your eating disorder where you haven't physically harmed your body so much that there are long-term major physical effects and you're dabbling in it. And there is, as a female, I know that there's more females than males out there that suffer with eating disorders, and they're also definitely more vocal about it. And so there is initially a phase of finding these almost underground cult groups of people who are similar-minded and people sharing tricks and tips and different things that they do. And so my eating disorder really started initially as purely anorexia, and then from the influence of roommates and from the influence of people that I met in college, I dabbled in bulimia, and then it was EDNOS for a while, where it was bulimia and anorexia somewhat meshed together. And I had a roommate in college who was very into exercising, so I involved over exercising, and it was very much influenced by the people around me and somewhat of a group effort, I guess you could say. There are a lot of negative chat forums online where you can go and you can find people who are also engaging in eating disorders. And there are a lot of fanatical people who name the disorders Anna and Mia. They attach female personas to them. And it is a very exciting somewhat. It's very exciting and it's very new. And then it's almost when someone starts delving into alcohol or drugs, there's a fun part to the beginning of it. And then it turns into just this weary, horrible cycle you cannot get out of and you don't know how to function without, and the habits are so ingrained, they're just there. And so that was the hardest part, was feeling the physical effects of it, seeing how much it was impacting my family, and just not knowing how to get out, and all that fun was just gone. And so that was sort of my descent into it, very much influenced by other females and males around me, and then the long haul to try and get out.
Were you binging at any point? I mean, were you?
No.
No. So your eating disorder did not involve binging. So I assume that you never really fell in love with food.
No, not at all. And it's very strange, because definitely before the sexual assault, I didn't have any feeling towards food. It was a part of life. It was very normal. You sit down for dinner, and our family, we were never big on the fast food and anything like that. My mother always had home-cooked meals and home-cooked desserts, and we always had a lot of fun baking and cooking together. That was a big thing, and it still is for our family now, and my sister does that with her children now, and I try and do that with my husband. So food was never good or bad until I associated it with being able to numb myself out, and then really fully falling early on in puberty, falling into having a negative behavior towards food. And then that mindset is so ingrained that now, 26, I still have to work through every time I have a meal and sit there and almost view it as more of it's fuel for your body and less, ooh, this tastes good. So,
tell me when you started to enter therapy for your condition, and what approach did the therapist take with you?
I think when I really focused on therapy and actually began to receive I guess, something back from it. There were a lot of therapy sessions that I attended that I paid absolutely no mind to. And the one that really did help me was behavioral therapy. That was very helpful. And the third treatment center that I went to, as well as the second, they were very focused on breaking down your feelings, finding that core feeling, and then working through that one. Because I did reach a stage where I was very angry and very violent. Just no matter what feeling I felt, it would translate into anger. And so that was the biggest help for me was, and I still do it to this day, I sit down and they called it the tornado, where you write your top feeling and what's the feeling underneath, and then underneath that until you come, oh, I'm sad. That's why I'm angry at my husband. I'm sad because he has to go tomorrow and I'm going to be by myself. And then you focus on the feeling of sadness instead of just trying to work on the anger that seems like it has absolutely no reason to be there. And so that was the journaling and the expressing yourself and the taking a moment to try and the meditation. That was very, very helpful. The therapy meditation that I did was also very helpful. And I guess any therapy that would slow me down enough to try and understand where my inner critic was coming from was the biggest breakthrough for me, definitely.
That inner critic, is she silenced?
Oh, no. No, it's still very much a daily battle. And I think it seems to, as one of my therapists had said in the past, you almost hit a plateau where you're doing very well and you're recovering very well. And then, for example, I smoked a lot and I quit smoking. But every few months, there's that all of a sudden you have this horrible craving. I want a cigarette right now. And you have to work through that. And it's similar where I'll do very well for a few weeks and then I'll get sick and then not be able to eat for a couple of days because of a sore throat. And then you're right back there with those feelings of this feels nice and you look better now. And aren't you more energetic now? And you kind of have to work through it all over again. So I'm very much in tune with having therapy available and nutritionists available and keeping my supportive network aware of where I'm at with my husband and my sister, and my family is very involved in making sure that I stay on track. And so I don't take it for granted that I'm doing well, because every time I do, then I just fall right back in. So,
Leonard, tell us about how you were managed in the midst of this anger and rage and a lot of it towards men. How did you manage to fall in love and get married?
I think the biggest difference between my husband and anyone else that I had ever had a relationship with is that we were friends first. And I always used to think that was silly when people would say that, oh, you need to be friends before there's a sexual side of the relationship or a romantic side. But we were friends for probably a good 3 or 4 years. And another thing that was different as well is that he was one of the only males that was aware of my eating disorder and losing my daughter. And he had already known about that and helped me with that with absolutely no reciprocal of sex. And that's something that I know affects a lot of people who are victims of sexual assault, especially young, is you feel like it's a payment. Oh, well, he paid for dinner, so I'll give him sex. Or he was nice to me, and so he must want sex. And he was the first person I had ever met who never was like that. And one of the other things that really was helpful is I always felt that if I was going to be in a relationship, it would need to be with someone who understood me exactly. And my husband is the opposite. He has absolutely no understanding of why I feel this way about food, and he has no issues with food. And so having a non-dramatic, poetic man who doesn't sit and pontificate about food with me and just says, well, eat it, it's good for you, eat it, is really helpful. Because sometimes there are times when I talk to him and I say, this salad tastes really bad, is it me or is it actually bad? And he'll taste it and say, no, it is actually bad. Or he'll taste it and say, it's fine, something's going on with you. And so having just a very rational, stable, practical person who doesn't understand me all the time but accepts my issues completely has been absolutely wonderful and definitely more than I deserve, but it's been a wonderful tool in my recovery. So
now why would you ever say it's more than you deserve? You deserve the world.
I think he's definitely taken on more in our relationship than I've had to. So, but
you know
I
what?
Do,
he's
I do
taken
know that
more,
he receives
but,
in
but
return.
You obviously give a lot of love and you're a very, very sincere person. And, you know, the trauma is really still with inside your head, you know, and it is, from my perspective, it's a battle of the competing brain dialogue of your frontal lobe, you know, versus, you know, that repetitive mammal brain. Because, you know, hearing your story, I so want you to have a life where this is behind you. And my question is, do you see that for yourself?
I do. I think for a long time I didn't, and I thought that this would be a continual struggle, but there has been little changes that I've noticed. There have been changes where I can look in the mirror and say, wow, you do look good today. And they're very minute little things that seem so silly, but they're great. You know, for the first time since I was maybe 4 or 5, I've worn shorts for the first time in the summer this year. And it's something so small and so silly to be 26 and thinking about that. But in the big picture, it is. And I think it's something where when people ask me, I will say for quite some time, yes, I am an anorexic. I'm a recovering anorexic, the same way that I wouldn't want to invalidate anyone who is an alcoholic and now they don't drink, but they still feel that they're an alcoholic or an ex-smoker, anything like that. But I do think that I'm hoping to reach a point where it's not going to be at the forefront of my mind. And slowly as the positive years of recovery go on and putting checks and balances for myself, a lot of it is just purely getting rid of those habits and getting your sense of hunger back and getting your sense of enjoyment of food back. And it takes a long time to break what almost 14 or 15 years worth of your mental perception of something. And so it's slow and it's arduous, but I do believe that there will come a point when that's not my first thought in the morning. It's, oh, breakfast, okay, instead of, oh, breakfast, oh. So I'm hopeful.
you should be, because there is ways to make that a shortcut, because you have really kind of worked through it. At what's your height and weight at this point?
I don't really ever mention my weight. I think that was something very important to me because of the books that I had read previously, where if someone approached that book with a negative outlook, they would start to compare themselves. But I am now, for the first time since I was probably about 13, at a normal BMI, and it's a low normal BMI, but it is the first time that I'm finally at a normal BMI, which is very exciting. And that happened last month, actually, when I went to see my nutritionist. I had finally reached that point. So
congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, that was very exciting. And so I'm definitely on the right path and definitely putting myself through the motions to really get myself at a healthy weight. So,
well, every single eating disorder is different and every single person's experience is different. So getting help, realizing that the way you think is very much going to determine the way you feel, and working through those competing thought processes can be challenging, yet at the same time, you know, when you're free completely, which I know you will be, I think it's just going to add just so much more to your life. You seem to have a wonderful family and a lot of support, and you know, for that, that's just wonderful.
Oh yes, and that is something that was important to me, and I do wish that I had put more. I think there was, when I was a teenager, there's that invincibility that you feel as a teenager, where I would listen to people say, if you continue to do this, this is what will happen to your body in the future. And now as a 26-year-old, there are a lot of long-term health issues that I've created for myself from all those years. And so I do want people to be aware of that. Those first initial years when those habits aren't as ingrained and those ideas aren't as fixated, it's very important to me for people when they're in their mid-teens to start realizing and taking it more seriously, and the families around them too. And I know for my parents, it almost seems like, and my mother even said, you know, oh, well, this must just be a phase. This is just a teenage girl phase, and they can be much more serious.
Right. What are the long-term health issues that they develop for you?
For me, well, let's see. I think probably the biggest ones was, I do have cardiomyopathy that I'm still having to deal with. I have osteoporosis, which is absolutely hideous, and I absolutely hate it. I know I have the bones that are on average of about a 60-year-old. I had scoliosis from birth, but from restricting so much, my back is absolutely horrible, and one doctor even said it looks like a snake is how bad my scoliosis is at this point, which is chronic pain. My nasal passages and my taste buds on my tongue have been eroded from acid. My teeth have been eroded, and so my sense of taste and smell are a lot less than they could be. It kind of constantly sort of feels like I have a cold, which is not something you want at the age of 26, and I've broken hips and wrists and ribs and cheeks and ankles and constantly just snapping bones all the time. My hips never fully grew through puberty because of the restricting that I was doing, and my uterus was so atrophied that I could possibly never have children, and my husband and I have been trying, and we have just a lot of miscarriages and a lot of failed attempts because of the infertility that's possibly there from the long-term restriction. And so there's just a lot of facets of your life that you really don't think about when you're a teen. Oh, well, I'm never going to have kids. Oh, well, who cares about my back? I'll figure that out when that happens. And I never really spent much time thinking about that or listening to my doctor's advice about my teeth or my health or the acid reflux that I have now or the little esophageal sphincter that's somewhat eroded. So when I lay down after I eat, acid comes in my mouth. And just there's a lot of chronic inconveniences and annoyances and pain that's there that I wouldn't have had to deal with if I had really started working on this when I was 18, 19, instead of starting when I was 25. So,
Elena, you know there used to be a show called Scared Straight where they took kids to prison and to make them afraid of ever going to jail. I just think that you just made a lot of people afraid of ever developing this disorder and if developing it, getting rid of it really quick, because that's a scary story.
It is. I mean, no one wants to be, you know, I'm almost at 2 years of marriage, and no one wants to have to sit their husband down when he proposes and say, thank you for proposing, I love you, but you may never have children with me, and then hoping that he'll accept that. And mine was wonderful and very much open to anything, adoption or just me. He loves me enough just for me. But that's something not every woman, but many women want to be a mother, and many women want to, you know, my husband's very active, and I can't go and participate in everything he does. And I have to be careful all the time. And there's a lot of things where if I, like I've said before, if I could go back to myself when I was 13, I would slap myself across the face and say, figure yourself out, because you're going to impact me as a 26-year-old a lot more than you think. And so that's something where that whole, oh, this is a very beautiful ethereal disease. It's not at all. And people should be more aware of that than I was when I was that age. So that's something that there's that quote, my life serves as a warning to others. Well, if it does, I'd be very happy if just one person heard that. And
you know what?
A
lot of people are going to hear that, and your life has meaning and has purpose, but now it's time to continue and have a life and continue to get healed. And, you know, I just wish you all the best.
Well, thank you very much. I'm becoming happy with myself, and self-love is most important. So it's been a long road, but it's been a good journey overall to accept myself. So
thank you, Elena, for coming to the show. I really appreciate
it. Thank you so much for having me.
I want to once again thank Elena for coming onto our show. Pick up a copy of her book, Elena Vanishing, now in paperback on Amazon, and be sure to check out her website, www.elenadunkel.com, for more information. I am Dr. Errol Gluck, and remember, to every problem there is a solution. This particular episode has brought a lot of different feelings coming up. Elena is such a sincere person. And, you know, her family are just so sincere. But there are years and years and years where the constant talk therapy, she simply deflected. There are therapies that are out there that could be used. Neuroplasticity, changing the way your brain processes, and not always giving the credence of the maddening brain, giving it validity so that the suffering is cut down in a much much less time. I am in no way implying that Elena did anything wrong. I am just strongly implying that one shouldn't have to suffer as long as she did. You can eliminate an eating disorder in a much more timely fashion, as I wish that happened with Elena. I'm Dr. Errol Gluck. I want you to remember, to every problem, there is really a solution. Check out our other episodes on gluckradio.com and on YouTube by searching for Errol Gluck. I want you to check out my website, glucksolutions.org, to learn more about how clinical hypnosis and executive life coaching can and will change your life. Thanks for listening. Till next time.